We want to smash, crash, bash, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will rejoin us next week. Today our theme is Capitalism and Empire. We will interview author Nick Terse about his new book, Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Operations in Africa. Then we turn our attention to Central America, where we talk with UC Santa Cruz professor Dana Frank and environmental attorney Mark Sullivan on the Honduras Charter City's plan and the continued U.S. back repression in Honduras. We hope you will stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Today our theme is Capitalism and Empire. We will interview author Nick Terse about his new book, Tomorrow's Battlefield, a U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Operations in Africa. Nick Terse holds a PhD from Columbia in sociomedical sciences. He turned his dissertation into a book on U.S. war crimes during the Vietnam War entitled Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Terse is an award-winning journalist, historian, a fellow at Nation Books, and managing editor of Tom's Dispatch. His newest book is Tomorrow's Battlefield, a U.S. Proxy War and Secret Ops in Africa. Nick Terse joins us by phone. Nick Terse, you write about the U.S. military being involved in Africa today. Is that part of a global American empire of control worldwide?
The U.S. does have something of an empire bases that's set up across the globe, and AFRICOM is U.S. Africa Command, which is the umbrella organization that governs military activity in Africa, is an integral part of that and the newest of the geographic campaigns. So in some sense, yes, you could say that this is a linchpin of the American empire base.
Well, you talk about in your book, Africa, the battlefield of tomorrow. Will Africa become like the Middle East is today, with wars everywhere and U.S. involvement and drones and all of that?
Well, in many ways, that's already begun. You know, after 9/11, the United States began to focus militarily on Africa to a much greater extent than it did before. Just after 9/11, when the U.S. military looked at the continent, though, they didn't find much in the way of transnational terrorists or Islamic terror groups. Basically, they found localized groups that had grievances within their own borders. Since the U.S. has been focused on Africa in the decade plus since 9/11, and since hundreds of millions of dollars have been pumped in, the U.S. has been running a lot of covert ops, setting up bases along the continent. Since that time, you've seen a proliferation of transnational terror groups, Islamic terror groups, Boko Haram, Ansaru, any number of militias that are operating out of Libya now, including a branch of the Islamic State. What had existed on the continent before was a group that became Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Once it was contained, now Al-Shabaab threatens all the countries surrounding Somalia. So in many respects, we're seeing the same type of situation that we've watched play out in the Middle East now being replicated in Africa.
Tell us a little bit about the research that you've done in Africa. We're well aware of your book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, which was a lot of record searches. But you were on the ground in Africa a great deal, and you give one incident where a 15-year-old child literally had an AK-47 in your face. So tell us a little bit of your experiences there.
Well, that particular instance that you're talking about happened in South Sudan, where I've spent the predominant amount of my time in Africa. And I've really focused on South Sudan because that was and is America's real nation-building project in action in Africa. This was a country that became independent in 2011. And as the now Secretary of State John Kerry says, the U.S. midwifed it. That's his term, not mine. Midwifed it into existence. This was an ongoing project from the 1980s onward to see South Sudan become an independent nation. And the U.S. put billions of dollars in humanitarian aid and military assistance into South Sudan to try and create a bulwark of democracy in the center of Africa And this really, this entire effort, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, imploded in December 2013 when South Sudan exploded into a civil war. The U.S. had spent a lot of time and effort trying to build up the South Sudan's military, but it was implicated in a tremendous number of mass atrocities and in the use of child soldiers. That's how I came to find myself on the wrong end of a 15-year-old's AK-47. For years, the United States looked the other way, actually did more than that. President Obama signed waiver after waiver to allow South Sudan to keep getting U.S. military assistance, even though it was violating the Child Soldiers Prevention Act, which is supposed to bar the United States from providing military assistance to armies that use child soldiers. But President Obama made this possible, and because of that, I found myself staring down the barrel of that gun.
And there's some now, what you write, 14,000 children engaged in that war on both sides?
That's right. About 13,000 to 14,000 children are now thought to be under arms. No one really knows the number because it's very difficult to get accurate figures, but somewhere in that range. And the South Sudanese government is recruiting child soldiers at an accelerated rate, and the rebel force there, the main rebel force headed by the former vice president of the country, and then there are a bunch of splinter militia groups around, and they're also doing their best to induct children into their ranks. So it's a very difficult and dangerous situation.
So a civil war like this has tremendous impacts on families in the region. You write the figure 600,000 children have been psychologically distressed, and that poverty, of course, continues, of malnourishment and deaths. We helped create that country, correct? And we armed the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and that in turn has split, and there's partly a tribal split. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. The split is largely among tribal lines between the current president, Salva Kiir, who's from the Dinka tribe, and the former vice president who he dismissed from government service, Riek Machar, who is from the Nuer tribe. They had an acrimonious split. Salva Kiir, the president, claims that his former vice president, Machar, was planning a coup. Machar says that Kiir did not want to give up power. Machar was planning to run for president against Kiir when he was ousted from power. So it's, you know, he said battle there, but, you know, it's turned into a tremendous nightmare for the people of South Sudan. So it's a war that has flared and simmered since December of 2013. Just recently, it's been in another flare state. The government has launched some significant offensives, and the rebels have as well. All of it, you know, really with South Sudan's oil fields in the sights of both forces. The government is almost entirely dependent for its revenue on the oil fields, and it only has one that's currently pumping any oil. This is what's being used to finance the entire war. So the rebels have their sights set on it. The government is doing their best to hold it. And in the process, it's average people in South Sudan who are suffering. The United Nations issued a report that said close to 5 million people are facing acute food insecurity in the months ahead, and that's going to fall, you know, disproportionately on women and on children.
Does the United States have special forces operating on one side or the other in the civil war?
Well, the United States had at least special operations forces on the ground for years in South Sudan. They'd set up what they called a Combined Operations Fusion Center in a small, out-of-the-way town called Zara. And they used this to conduct joint operations with South Sudanese commandos and to carry out training missions there. Now, officially, the U.S. government has suspended most of its military aid to South Sudan since the Civil War began. So, at least officially, there are no U.S. special ops troops operating in the country. It's always exceptionally opaque and difficult to verify any of that. So, I don't know for sure, but the official answer is that there are no commandos operating there at the moment.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. We're going to take a short break, and we'll return to our conversation with Nick Terse. This is the Project Censored Show. We've been speaking with author Nick Terse about his book, Tomorrow's Battlefields, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Operations in Africa. So part of the geopolitical agenda in Africa, my understanding is from the U.S. perspective, is to challenge China's immersion. In fact, China is actually doing more trade with Africa than the U.S. So there's been a challenge to China. And is that political, geopolitical agenda at play in the South Sudan civil war? And who's buying the oil there now?
Yeah, China is very much a part of the equation in South Sudan. Chinese and Indian oil companies that control the lion's share of the oil in South Sudan. China had invested heavily in the oil infrastructure in Sudan, and when South Sudan broke away, it took most of the oil wealth with it. So China followed and really made a play and got a hold of South Sudanese oil. While the U.S. was busy, you know, working with the South Sudanese military, the Chinese pursued an economic track based on the oil. And, you know, as I alluded to before, the government of South Sudan doesn't have to cater to its own people. It doesn't have to provide services or transparency. What it has to do is cater to Chinese oil companies, because 90 to 98%, depending on the year, of its revenue comes from the Chinese. So China plays an outsized role in the country. And the Chinese have really used this to their advantage vis-a-vis the United States. They've done something unprecedented, I think. They began this about a year and a half ago, of figuring out a way to get Chinese troops on the ground in South Sudan. And now they have almost an entire infantry battalion on the ground protecting oil installations. They've done it through the auspices of the United Nations, which the United States pays about 25% of that tab for UN peacekeepers. So effectively, China figured out a way to get American taxpayers to foot the bill to have Chinese troops on the ground protecting Chinese oil installations in South Sudan. I think that might tell you all you need to know about who's succeeding and who's failed in South Sudan.
That was really amazing to read that, because we support the UN, the UN is there, and now the Chinese have troops in South Sudan, partly paid for by the UN. That to me is amazing. Is this kind of Chinese payback for their losses in Libya?
Well, I think that, you know, China, they did lose a great deal of oil infrastructure and oil supplies coming out of Libya with that war. So I think South Sudan loomed ever larger for them as a place to get oil. It's also a coveted type of oil in South Sudan. It doesn't need to be refined to the extent of a lot of other types of oil. So this was something the Chinese, I think, felt was integral to get a hold of. So they really pursued it with great vigor. As they do all across the continent, the Chinese have made great infrastructure investments. South Sudan is no exception, where the U.S. has been running around Africa's 53 countries playing whack-a-mole with terror groups. The Chinese have, again, pursued a real economic route. And what they've done is in exchange for oil, for minerals, for natural resources, they've been building roads, stadiums, government buildings, big public works projects that are tangible, that Africans can see with their own eyes. And this is another way where the Chinese have gotten a hold of U.S. dollars. Because these Chinese government-backed corporations, they're the main companies that are willing to work in Africa. When the U.S. Millennium Development Fund had tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to spend in a place like Mali, they couldn't find an American company who wanted to go there and build. So these American tax dollars were sent to Chinese firms who were willing to do the construction there. So again, it's a case of American taxpayer dollars heading into Chinese coffers.
I like your allusion to whack-a-mole. I mean, because certainly a number of so-called terrorist groups have emerged, or groups that were already there. Rebel groups have been labeled terrorists, or Al-Qaeda linked, or ISIS linked in some fashion in terms of American media. But it certainly is an interesting description. Private military contractors have been active in Africa for years. Do they play a role in South Sudan? I knew G4S had some operations going on there before the Civil War.
I think there are private military contractors on the ground. I've never run into them myself. I've even heard whispers of former South African Defense Force contractors on the ground there helping the government side of late. But the South Sudanese military, the SPLA, has really leaned heavily on Uganda, neighbor next door. There are Ugandan troops on the ground in the country right now. They're functionally operating as mercenaries in the service of Salva Kiir's government. And they played an outsized role in protecting his government, especially in the opening days of the civil war, providing air power to blunt a rebel advance that could have swept through the capital and swept Kiir from power. So that's, I think, the most potent foreign force in the country. But I believe there are military contractors on the ground, and then the rebel forces, they're receiving aid from other countries in the region, most notably Sudan to the north.
Are drugs at play here? Brian Murphy, an African scholar we interviewed about a year ago, he subsequently has passed away. We miss him a lot. He talked about the cocaine trafficking through Africa from South America that was on the way to Europe. Have you run into that or seen that?
I've certainly read about that, and I think there in West Africa, it looms large. There's major trafficking route from South America. But it's not something that I've focused in on greatly, but it's certainly on the U.S. military's radar, on AFRICOM's radar, and they see it as part of a whole melange of instability that exists on the continent.
I'm reading where you talk about how the U.S. has token presence in 49 African countries, that we're actually building bases and a logistics network. Let's get back to the original question I asked. Are we looking at levels of Middle East war likely to occur throughout the African continent? And you had said that in a way it was already happening, and certainly in the Congo, that's been one of the major wars of the world. Well, we see more in-depth U.S. involvement in all of these.
It seems like, everything is leading that way. If you look at just the scale of U.S. operations on the continent, when AFRICOM came into existence back in 2008, it ran about 172 missions each year. That's roughly one every 2 days. This past year, AFRICOM ran about 675 missions. So we're talking about, nearly two missions per day on the continent. It's a tremendous ramping up of U.S. military activity. Over that time, we've seen a proliferation of bases, many of them used to fly surveillance drones or even armed drones, which have been used in Somalia. So, I think that we're very much on the way to at least the possibility of the same type of engagement in Africa that we've seen in the Middle East.
Nick Tersh, your new book is Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and the Secret Ops in Africa, which is just recently out, I believe. What are some of the secret ops that we don't know about that you talk about here?
I try to at least give the bare outlines of special forces operations that are being conducted in places like Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Central African Republic, in South Sudan, Uganda, Kenya, all these countries. The United States is running missions with Green Berets, special forces from the Army, Navy SEALs. They're looking to build up relationships with local forces. They're conducting proxy wars using French and African troops in places like Central African Republic and Mali. So I try to give people just at least a glimpse of all the many operations that have been going on these last years that you're not likely to see on the front page of the newspaper or leading the nightly news. Africa is generally off the radar, and I'm just trying to let people know what's going on with their tax dollars in their name.
Nick Tersh, you're a Nation Fellow. You're a managing editor of Tom's Dispatch. Is that a good place to look for updates on these issues?
Yes. I've been covering the U.S. military in Africa at Tom's Dispatch now for, I guess, the last 3 years or so. And, I'm going to be following up on this for the foreseeable future. There's a lot of countries, and the U.S. military does its best to keep what it does in Africa under the radar, so I'm going to keep digging.
Well, Nick Tersh, thank you for being on the Project Censored show and giving this update on and the big concerns about what's going on in Africa and what will happen in the future. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, great. This is the Project Censored show. I'm Peter Phillips. Up next, we'll be talking with Santa Cruz professor, UC Santa Cruz professor Dana Frank, and environmental attorney Mark Sullivan, on the Honduras Charter Cities Plan and the continued U.S.-backed repression in Honduras. The World Health Organization reports that in Honduras there are an average of 102 murders for every 100,000 people, a figure that qualifies as making it the most violent place on the planet. The proposed solution is a tiny group of politicians and business people want to carve out zones within the country for financial capital to create islands of affluence surrounded by a sea of poverty and violence. Please stay tuned. Well, we welcome to our show Dana Frank, a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the author of several books. And since the 2009 military coup, her articles and op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, NACLA, Los Angeles Times, The Chronicle, Los Angeles Times, and regularly on The Nation magazine. Welcome, Dana.
Thanks so much for having me.
In studio with us today is Mark Sullivan. He's an environmental attorney. His current focus is promoting a greater understanding of environmental justice and human rights in Central America, particularly in Honduras. Mark has organized and participated in several delegations to Honduras and was a leader of the National Lawyers Guild observer delegation in November 24, 2013 Honduran elections. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
It's great to have you both. Honduras has been very interesting to me, and I'm kind of like Dana to give us a little history of what's been happening there. There was a coup. The U.S. was certainly helped back. What's been happening up before the coup and up to the present?
Honduras has long been a so-called captive nation of the United States, ruled by two ruling right-wing parties and an elite family known as the oligarchs that, along with transnational corporations, control almost the entire Honduran economy. And the U.S. has long shored up regimes in this country. In 2009, there was a sort of centrist president that was not to the U.S. liking, and there was a he was democratically elected, named Manuel Zelaya. In 2009, 6 years ago, on June 28th, there was a military coup that overthrew President Manuel Zelaya, and ever since then, there's been a series of regimes that have come to power both through the coup and through very illegitimate elections that have really thrown open the door to the almost total destruction of the rule of law in Honduras. I think people may be aware that Honduras now has the highest murder rate in the world. Gangs and violence have proliferated, and it's been a tremendous economic and human rights disaster ever since the coup.
To what extent was that really forced on the people in Honduras by the elites, and maybe an obvious question, by U.S. influence?
I mean, the U.S. has long had the very important military base, Sotocano Air Force Base at Palmarolo in Honduras. It has long supported these two right-wing parties that have traded off power for decades. We don't have a smoking gun showing that the U.S. supported the coup, but we do. It's very clear that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, with President Obama's approval, backed the stabilization and long-term legitimation of the post-coup regime. And certainly there was tremendous resistance to the coup afterwards, even as many, in the course of the next 2-3 years, as many as 1 million people in the streets, for example, in a country that only has 8 million people. And the resistance was an amazing coalition, in many ways across the political spectrum, and the kind of coalition of social movements that we dream of here in the United States.
Mark Sullivan, you were an observer with the National Lawyers Guild delegation to the November 2013 elections. Were those fair elections?
It was interesting because in order to understand those elections, you really have to look at the context in which those elections took in. And Dana's beginning to frame what the context of those elections were, but there has been repression happening in Honduras. There's been impunity, and those were represented in the elections as well. So we went down there, evaluated the elections. We were certified election observers. And we had several questions, not just about what happened on election day, but what happened leading up to those elections, because some of the opponents in the Libre Party, which was a left-of-center party, had been harassed all the way up to being murdered, and their supporters had been harassed in the lead-up to those elections. And so we had some serious questions about the free and fairness of those elections. We also have questions about the transparency of those elections, because there were serious questions about the counts after those elections that were never really addressed by their election tribunal, which was heavily represented by this national party, which is the ultra-conservative party of the president today.
This highest death rate per capita in the world, is that partly related to narco-trafficking?
A lot of it is people who, refuse to go along with a deal or are on the wrong side of some kind of drug trafficking conversation that goes nasty. But it's really important to understand that the drug traffickers are allowed to proliferate because the top levels of the government, and including current President Juan Orlando Hernandez and his predecessor Porfirio Lobo, have allowed this and the continuing destruction of the rule of law itself. So there's almost a 98% impunity rate. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of the OAS has confirmed. So when you have judges that are corrupt, you have clean judges that were deposed for opposing the coup that have never been restored, you have a government that itself is allegedly linked to drug traffickers. Previous President Porfirio Lobo's son was just arrested in Haiti by the DEA a couple of weeks ago for drug trafficking. So it's important to say that, yes, there's spectacular violence that is coming from drug traffickers, but also anybody can kill anybody they want. It's not just drug trafficking, it's organized crime, it's gangs. And again, they proliferate in this context of impunity that the United States countenances, that the government enters, even encourages. The president of Honduras, Juan Orlando, the current president, has twice promoted to the very top positions among the national police. One documented torturer of the members of the opposition after the coup, and another one who has also committed vast human rights abuses. So in the dialogue in the U.S. media, it's always gangs and violence in sort of generic way. But it's really important to say that all of that proliferates in this context of of the deliberate breakdown of the rule of law. There's also tremendous domestic violence. There's tremendous repression of people who are defending indigenous and campesino land rights. And also just in general, you can just get mad at somebody and kill them and nothing will happen to you. And that's the kind of context that we're talking about here.
Wow, that sounds really, really terrifying. When's the next election there? Is there a chance to reverse this via an electoral process? Or are we so far gone now, particularly with this new model cities proposal, that we're really looking at a neocon state?
I'll let Mark speak to the model cities. In terms of the next election isn't until November of 2017, so they're every 4 years. So, and the other piece of this is that the electoral procedures are now controlled by the current ruling party. There have been a great number of protests about the way they have stacked the deck of the Supreme Electoral Commission. When there were protests about this outside the Honduran Congress in May of 2013, the army and the military and the new military police tear gassed the protesters and beat them up. And the opposition party Libre, the center left, the second largest party in the Congress, was protesting this from inside the Congress, and the government's military police surrounded, tear gassed, beat up, and ejected 35 members of Congress while this was all going on, and they were protesting these issues about the control over the electoral machinery. So even if there is election, it's not for, you know, a long time, in November of 2017, and by that point, who knows quite how terrible the situation will be.
Mark, the model cities, and it's a funny name to me because I was active in the war on poverty, and there was a model cities here in the United States at that time, which I don't think that's anything like what was being proposed here. Tell us what's happening in terms of these free trade zones that are being proposed in Honduras.
Yeah, the model cities really represent an expansion of the free trade zones to an extreme degree. And so within free trade zones, you have one or a group of companies that are producing a product and they get favorable tax and duty-free status. It's all economic. With the model cities, it's a much larger expansion of that because in the model cities, these are areas that are autonomous city-states, really, that develop their own government. So they're all responsible for the three branches of government. And then they perform all of the social functions and economic functions of society. And so you think about they will be providing police, the courts, healthcare, education, social security, utilities, all those functions are going to be provided by this private entity or public entity that is in control of the Zed under the observation of a Committee for Best Practices, which is a 21-member executive board, essentially, of international free trade thinkers who are neoliberals primarily from the United States. Of the 21, 9 members of this Committee for Best Practices is from the United States, and the rest of them are from EU and some other Latin American countries. Only 4 of the members are from Honduras.
This is for the first one's proposed, right? That's what, Zacatecas?
Zacate Grande, yeah. Zacate. In the Zacate Grande area, there are actually 3 that have been proposed by this Korean Development Agency. And they are undergoing the feasibility studies right now, but there was an early form of the feasibility studies which indicated that there are 3 areas. One area is going to be a mega port, so it's going to be a huge port in Amapala, which is a small island of fisher people in the Gulf of Fonseca, which is on the Pacific coast. And then there are going to be another area which they're going to develop as basically infrastructure for that port in order to process all of the shipping goods. It's going to be a mega huge port. There's a small one there now, but it's going to displace that. And then the third ZA or model city has been proposed as an agricultural research station also near the same area. But one of the troubling things about each of these developments are that there was no plebiscite and there's no referendum on the part of the people to vote whether they want these structures in place where they live. And so there's a lot of apprehension on the part of the people. When we visited there last year, the people were so uninformed about what these things were. They were asking us questions because we had read the law. We understood it better than they did. The information that's being provided by their government is really bereft of anything substantive. They're just trying to sell these things. It's a PR campaign is what it is.
So you could be living in a village in Honduras and be imposed on by the Zeta that is run by neoliberal economic committee of mostly foreigners, and they would have total control over your life. In other words, there would be no democratic process whatsoever. Is that how I'm reading this? Is really kind of a neoliberal economic experiment of zone control, of people control.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they would take full control over the people who live their lives. And one of the arguments that the people who control the Zetas go are that, oh, well, you can vote with your feet. The problem with voting with your feet is that these people have been living in these places for decades, in some cases longer. And their livelihoods are very well established. They're campesino farmers, they're fisher people, they're very humble people, and many of them are not interested in seeing huge developments around them. Furthermore, many of them don't have title to their lands because the form of the legal hurdles that are created, it's just a Byzantine system in order to be able to gain control of your land in Honduras. And so many of them will be left landless and will get no remuneration for their land because the Zeta is required to provide value for the land. The problem is they're the ones who get to decide what the value of your land is, and you take it or you leave it.
I would just underscore, you know, what Mark is saying, that, you know, the Constitution, Honduran Constitution itself doesn't apply inside these zones, and the Supreme Court has ruled that, and this is just part of the sort of end product or the end of a scale of the overthrowing of the Honduran Constitution, from the coup to the extending of the military into the domestic policing in the last 3 years, to the ruling that the Zetas are, the model cities are constitutional when they actually say the Constitution and the Honduran rule of law don't apply, which is a sort of really so unbelievable. And, you know, one of the people, I just want to underscore that one of the people on that governing board is Grover Norquist, who is the leader of the Tea Party of the United States, if you want to get a sense of who the players are here. And that process of throwing out the Constitution is ongoing in Honduras. The Supreme Court that's been making these rulings was, in part, the constitutional branch was overthrown by the current president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, when he was president of Congress in December of 2012 in the so-called technical coup. Four members of the constitutional branch of the Honduras Supreme Court were deposed, and new members loyal to Juan Orlando Hernandez were named the next day. That court then has in turn ruled that the model cities were legal. That court has ruled all kinds of things in favor of Juan Orlando, including ruling that the Constitution, again, doesn't apply in the question of reelection, and that the president can, in fact, be reelected, although the Constitution, written in 1982, after two decades of military rule, is very explicit that the president can't even advocate reelection, let alone be reelected.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. We're talking with Dana Frank and Mark Sullivan, and we will have a musical break and continue the conversation on Honduras. We'll be right back. This is the Project Censored Show. You're listening to Dana Frank. She's a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And with us also is Mark Sullivan, environmental attorney, one of the leaders from the National Lawyers Guild report on Honduras. I'd like to ask this general question. Where is this coming from? I mean, there's a real deep neoliberal philosophy here that's coming forward, and we're seeing it manifest in Honduras. We can go back to Chile in the 70s and the implementation of some very neoliberal. So where is this coming from? Is this the Chicago School of Economics? And how is this being manifested, not just around the world, but certainly here in Honduras, where we're seeing kind of just the tip of the iceberg?
The model cities are getting a lot of attention, but there's, you know, other vast things going on about neoliberalism in Honduras that are not about the model cities, although it's partly, obviously, all of a piece. And the biggest piece of this is this tremendous privatization that's going on and destruction of the public sector, led by the International Monetary Fund and the Inter-American Development Bank. So part of the coup itself was in part because deposed President Zelaya was opposing some of these privatizations. And they've accelerated dramatically in the last year under Juan Orlando Hernandez. So the state-owned telephone company is being privatized. The ports are being privatized. The National Health Service is being privatized. And there's a big scandal that we can talk about how checks from money that was stolen from the National Health Service, helping bankrupt it, have gone to the National Party. But that bankruptcy itself, many people point out, was then used as a pretext for the privatization of the National Health Service and leading to its destruction and obviously inaccessibility. So these cascading, the state-owned power company similarly has been allowed to have problems and fall apart and then used as a pretext for privatization. And the IMF is totally behind that. The executive board last spring said, we're helping the Honduran government lower their wage bill, quote unquote. It's behind this tremendous destruction of public sector jobs and public sector unions. The government said in December that it was going to cut the public bills by 30% of public expenditures, and that tremendous destruction of public sector jobs. So this whole IMF-IDB plan, they don't move like that without the United States government and other global interests in this tremendous destruction of the Honduran state. And you'll hear the references to this Honduran state being a failed state, but it's actually not a failed state. It's functioning to militarily take over and at the same time create this paradise for the destruction of people's health, but also for transnational corporations to buy things up right and left. And I want to underscore here the environmental side of this. 30% of the entire country has been giving away mining concessions, and that means tremendous assault on indigenous and campesino land rights, just vast mining and hydroelectric dam projects that are just destroying the environment and people's livelihoods. So it's really important to understand that this is driven by very conscious U.S. policy in support of transnational corporations and the Honduran elite. It's not just happening. There are policies behind these IMF and IDB loans and this whole privatization push, and that is, again, fantasy neoliberalism at the point of a gun in Honduras, which is being used as this playground for U.S. transnational foreign corporation-driven foreign policy.
So, Dana, we're talking here like they're proposing 14, 16 zones in Honduras. What would prevent this being imposed on entire countries, or what are called failed states, to have this kind of committee of best practices, corporate management of what have been traditionally nation states?
Well, in order to have this happen, you have to have local elites agree to that, and you know, local elites may not necessarily, you know, to stop this. I mean, I guess maybe the question is, what can stop this? I mean, the Honduran people are incredibly brave. They're protesting and being killed for this as we speak. There's a tremendous resistance right now going on to the corruption of the government. There are actually snowballing demonstrations in the streets about the corruption of the government, about the destruction, including the privatization of the National Health Service and Social Security system. And there are opposition parties, one of the center-left, Libre, and the other one of the far-right, but seriously against corruption, called the Partido Anticorrupción, the Anti-Corruption Party. You know, there are also lots of people in Congress that are paying attention to this, and they're paying attention to it because of a network of solidarity in the United States with these social movements and people interested in the constitutional rule of law and democracy in Honduras.
Mark, let's kind of go back to the original philosophy here. Who is Paul Romer, and what role does he play in all of this?
Well, Paul Romer is an economist, conservative economist. He now teaches as a professor at NYU. And he presented a TED Talk in 2009 in which he proposed these charter cities. And his idea of the charter cities was really to create a semi-autonomous area that operated outside of the functions of the host government and operated within its own economic system, kind of another step forward from the free trade zone idea, only incorporating some governmental functions into these semi-autonomous areas. And in the first iteration of this law called the Red Law in Honduras, they followed the Paul Romer model, really, where it was a more mild version of what the new Zede law is. And so there was a transparency commission on that law, and the idea was that the land would ultimately revert back to the sovereign nation of Honduras after a specified number of years. Then that law, as we now know, was shown to be unconstitutional, or was decided to be unconstitutional. Four of the five justices who voted as such were removed, replaced by those that were friendly. The new Zede law doesn't have those protections of a transparency commission. It doesn't have the provision that the land will revert back. And in many ways is a much worse law than the original model cities law that was passed in Honduras in 2011. But this is the law that they're moving forward with, and this is the law that South Korea is now developing, these three ZAs, and in Zacate Grande.
And I read in the National Lawyers Guild report that there's some of these operational in China. We're talking about Korea, around the world, these trade zones, but increasingly more privatized, so that the ones proposed in Honduras is that these private companies would have their own control of the region and their own police force, their own court systems. So I could see someone like a G4S, which is the largest security company in the world, becoming the police force as a private security, private military company inside of these zones.
Yeah, so everything inside of the zone is going to be owned by the private company or controlled by this Committee for the Adoption of Best Practices. And all of those governmental functions are going to be privately ran. And this is ultimately an extension, because you said, oh, yeah, we've seen this in Singapore, we've seen it in Hong Kong. This is really a blatant extension of what happened in those places. It's never been done in the world to this extent, where sovereign territory has been ceded to private entities for the development, where they develop their own constitution, their own legal system, etc. And so when we read the propaganda about these things, we always read that, oh, you know, this has been done before in these places and it's been shown to be very functional. And no, it hasn't been done before. And so that's part of the problem, is that this is brand new.
I would just underscore that this is a tremendous form of colonialism. It's a modernized form of colonialism. And in Honduras, that's a long history from the United Fruit and Standard Fruit's banana plantations, in which United Fruit had its own army, had its own rule of law in many ways, to the maquiladora sector and the export processing zones, which is almost impossible to enter if you're not working there, and which have all kinds of tax concessions and are almost, this is on a continuity from that, and that all of these are forms of colonialism in which money is, and people's labor are abstracted. And, you know, if you read these people talking about it, and the business press is salivating all this. I mean, this is like some fantasy. You wouldn't believe how many people in the English language press are writing that, all the way to the New York Times Magazine having an article about the model cities 3 years ago, and it had an actual little picture illustration, and it had a little sign that said, "This way to Honduras, the good Honduras, not the bad Honduras." I mean, this is like just sort of a sickening kind of colonialist way of talking about what's going on in Honduras.
What does this say for human rights and habeas corpus and that for the people that live there?
habeas corpus won't exist in these zones, and because all basic rights under the Constitution, they won't have a Bill of Rights anymore unless it's decided by the Committee for the Adoption of Best Practices that they do. But these are a lot of the things that are up in the air that we have no idea about what this committee is going to adopt, but we do know what their leanings are. And so that's why the reason who live in these areas are extremely concerned about, where they're going to stand once these things come down. And it's happening rather quickly because, as you know, the law, as I mentioned, the law then passed in 2014. We have a feasibility study that's already being prepared. It's actually late. It should be out any day now. And they are moving forward with full speed ahead on these projects. And so, you know, we're going to find out in short order what's going to be happening, but it's going to impact almost every aspect of the people who are living within these areas' lives.
What about labor rights and union rights?
All the labor rights and the union rights are going to be determined by this Committee for the Adoption of Best Practices. And you can imagine, because we know what the labor rights are within the free trade zones, non-existent, and so they won't have the ability to unionize and to organize. And the environmental laws, like Dana was saying, are out the window. So in one section of the law, I was reading it yesterday, it says that the ZA should adopt practices that don't pollute the environment. That's the only mention of environment in the document.
And, you know, if they wanted to respect the rule of law, they respect the rule of Honduran law. Honduran labor law is actually, in many ways, there are parts of it that are very progressive. I mean, there are plenty of laws you can be respecting. I mean, the whole point of this is to evade the rule of law, to evade controls on environmental destruction, to evade land rights, to evade labor rights, to hyper-exploit people and the environment, and to have these privatized military and domestic policing so that you don't have democratic controls over the police. I mean, this is really terrifying. And this is the vision not only the Zetis. I mean, the Zetis are like this sort of, you know, nightmare fantasy. But it's important to understand that this is going on in the whole country, this vision of privatized security, militarized security at the point of a gun rather than domestic policing by a non-corrupt police, this tremendous exploitation of labor that's going on in the whole country, this destruction of the public sector, the destruction of labor rights, and the destruction of indigenous and campesino and Afro-indigenous land rights. And maybe we can talk about it a little bit before we... Vice President Biden is asking for $1 billion in funding for Central America in the current appropriations process in Congress, and much of that money, a big chunk of it, goes to Honduras, not only tripling military funding, but responding to the so-called crisis of unaccompanied kids at the border with a tremendous beefing up of security forces to keep people from leaving at all, and tremendous support for this repressive regime that people are fleeing.
Okay, Mark, any last words? We got to wrap this up.
Okay, yeah, I will say that we are going back next month and to Zacate Grande to talk to the communities and to find out what's happening in those communities. And so we're going to have some discussions and talks, at least here in the Bay Area, in probably late October. So maybe some of your listeners can go to the NLGinternational.org website, and information about those will be available there.
Dana Frank, last words from you.
Thank you so much for having us, and I would encourage people to, you know, keep reading about Honduras and to contact your member of Congress and your senator and express your outrage about U.S. policy and U.S. support for this regime. We're back to the worst kind of support for repressive regimes in Latin America. There are a lot of interest and concern about all of this in Congress, and people do pay attention to the Congress, to their constituents. So all the listeners of this, I would encourage you to call your Congress member and your senator. It's very easy to do, and all you have to say is, you know, your opinion on this. You can say, please cut all police and military aid to Honduras. You can say, question this funding and celebration of going on of the government of Honduras, including the Zetas and model cities and this neoliberal project. And also, why are we shoring up a government that has committed tremendous human rights against its own people with near complete impunity, and is now documented to have received money stolen from the National Health Service, and it's just humming right along as far as the State Department and the White House are concerned.
What's the best website to keep updates here?
Honduras Resists is a good one. I think that you can follow the mainstream news. It's got some good stuff. I mean, VozElSoberano.com, if you understand Spanish, is very good. And Honduras Culture and Politics Blogspot sometimes has good stuff.
That sounds really great. Thanks so much for being on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That concludes our program. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fess, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table.